Welcome to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast that explores the creative and curious world of work through monologues and conversations with artists, creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, and changemakers. From philosophy professor to ghostwriter and entrepreneur, today's guest on Getting Work to Work has fascinating insights into the world of ideas, words, and collaboration. Emily Crookston, aka the Pocket PhD, loves working with rebels, renegades, and mavericks who not only innovate and disrupt the status quo, but want to pass their knowledge and wisdom along. In this conversation, Emily talks about how she's learned to collaborate, the art of giving and receiving feedback, the most crucial question she asks a prospective client, and the role empathy plays in her creative process. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/587. What are you endlessly curious about?
Yeah, this is such a fun question. I am endlessly curious about almost everything, I think. I think that's actually what makes me good at what I do as a ghostwriter. I can get into the sausage with almost any author and really dig in and you know, anything from how to sell your business to how to start your business to how to how your public floor works, you know, any of that stuff. I love to dig into it with my authors and ask the questions that really draw out, you know, the stuff the readers want to know. So yeah, I think that's one of my strengths, is getting into the shoes of your audience and asking like what they need to know. So yeah.
Fascinating. Cause it's like, it's not only getting in the shoes of the audience, but like you said, the brain of the person that you're working with.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's the beauty of collaboration. I think it's just, you know, I can talk about what I want to talk about, but with the right partner to bounce ideas off of, man, it's just like magic. You get so much more rich ideas that way. Mm.
So it is interesting because you mentioned ghostwriter, and immediately, like, I have all of these mental pictures kind of popping up, you know, like the wizard behind the curtain, you know, like making everything happen. So like, what does a ghostwriter actually do?
Yeah. Pulling all the strings. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's cool. You know, I don't know very much about how other ghostwriters work. I only know the way that I work. And what I do is really collaborative. It's a 16-week process that we go through. I meet with my authors once a week and we talk through different parts of the book, and then I go away and write. And they basically do the editing in most cases, or they have me do the editing. So what I find is that, you know, it's really a collaborative process all the way through. Mm-hmm. And so I don't feel like, the last thing I want is for my authors to feel like, oh, I don't really feel like I own this book when it's finished. Yeah. You know, I've worked with people more in that line where they're like, here's a topic and okay, I'll see you in 6 months. I did that once and I was very uncomfortable. It was like me and Google writing that book. And I just thought, if anyone interviewed you about this book, I don't know how you would answer their questions because you right. don't know what's in here, you know? So I much prefer to work that way where it's really a mind meld in the end. That's the goal.
Immediately, I thought of that scene from the movie Ed TV. I don't know if you remember that movie with Matthew McConaughey, but his brother's Woody Harrelson.
Oh yeah.
And like in the span of a week, he comes out with this book and he couldn't answer the questions. And so every response to the interview was like, just read the book. It's in the book.
right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, my authors, they're the experts. I don't know anything about this topic, which is why, you know, I don't feel like I have ownership over the book when it's finished. But you know, yeah, I want their expertise in there. So I'm like, always going to be pressing them for more information the whole way through.
That's so interesting. And what's so fascinating too, Emily, is like, you know, when you think of the process that you go through and being a ghostwriter, because you're so curious about so many things, it's like you have the best of both worlds between being a generalist and a specialist. So generalist in the sense of taking in all of this input, but specialist in like the writing process.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that that's one of the things I love the most about the job, because I get to spend 4 months learning about a topic that I, you know, I have to get up to speed really fast. And I have to figure out, you know, what's interesting here, you know, what's the stuff we really want to drill down quickly to figure out what the book is really about. And it's, I just find it a really exhilarating process from start to finish. It's really cool.
So when you dive into something, are you looking for something in particular? Do you have like a refined spidey sense about what is going to pique your curiosity? Or is it more, you're just like a blank slate?
Yeah, you know, when I start out, I would describe it more as a blank slate. I always require, the one requirement I have for my authors is to come to me with a working outline. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you can outline a book, then you have wrapped your mind around kind of the big picture. And that's the most important thing to me, because I've also worked with authors who had less of a, you know, it was more fuzzy, exactly what they're, I always talk in terms of transformation. You know, your reader starts at point A, and by the end of the book, they're at point B. What does that look like? And if they haven't thought through that piece, it can be really challenging, because then it feels like we really are kind of building the bridge under our feet. And that's not the best place to be. You know, I like it much better when I can see kind of from the very beginning, like, okay, I see where we're going. I might not know where all the pieces fit yet. But at least I can keep that in my mind. Like, this is the big theme, and we're going to keep hammering on that in all these different facets and ways. So that's really helpful. But, you know, from the beginning, I am kind of a blank slate. I like to take in all the information and then see what spits out, you know, what resonates. And again, I'm always trying to put on that reader's hat and think about what would resonate for them, not just for me. Right. But I do think it's helpful that I'm not an expert in your subject, because that makes me closer to your reader than you are. And that's one of the challenges of writing a book is, you know, I know everything there is to know about this topic, and now I have to figure out how to talk to people who maybe are brand new to hearing about it. And that can be a real challenge.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that sounds like the what's the phrase I'm thinking of? Like the value proposition of hiring a ghostwriter, especially if you're an expert, so that you can have that fresh look at the topic.
Yeah, exactly. I think that is the value proposition for sure. Hmm.
So where did the name Pocket PhD come from? Because when I saw the name of your company, I just like thought that was the best name ever.
Oh, awesome. Thanks. Yeah, it's funny. You know, I used to be a professor. I used to teach philosophy.
Naturally.
Yeah, of course. Like, what else would I have done? Yes. Used to teach philosophy. And so, of course, when I started my business, I wanted a connection to that past identity. I wasn't quite ready to give it all up. And I really thought, you know, people in the business world, they're going to be very impressed that I have a PhD. You know, how many entrepreneurs have PhDs, you know, this kind of stuff. And I quickly found my way to some mentors who were saying to me, actually, it might not be all the you know, sweetness and light when they hear that you're a professor. They might worry that you're kind of stuffy, you know, I mean, all these stereotypes that people have about professors. But, you know, the name, I just felt so strongly when I came, you know, hit that name. The thing I like the most about it is, you know, when you start your business, you don't always know what that business is going to look like in the end, you know? And I wanted something flexible enough where, you know, if I decided to start an agency, for example, it might be cool to think, oh, we're going to put a PhD in your pocket. You know, you don't need to get the PhD yourself, but you could actually hire an expert PhD to help you with whatever business problem you're trying to solve.
Right.
So that was what I came up with. And, you know, there was some pushback also about, well, the Pocket PhD doesn't tell anybody you're a ghostwriter. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Nike doesn't tell anybody that they sell shoes. And, you know, so, you know, branding is a whole separate can of worms, right? Exactly. Yeah. So I say pick a name that, you know, people like and they can remember and, you know, fly from there.
Exactly. Oh, that's interesting. Because what I appreciate about that, too, is you, in a sense, have brought this outline to your business about what a business could be. But just like when you outline a book, things change through mm-hmm. the writing process, just like things change in business.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. Yeah. And I do have a really strong tie to, like, I want my business to be about teaching. Mm-hmm. So anyone I hire, like, I have a writing apprentice who I hired this year. Yeah. And, you know, the idea behind the apprentice is maybe you're thinking about starting a ghostwriting business, or you're thinking about starting a writing business of some kind, copywriting or whatever it is.
Right.
Work for me, help me out. And in the process of that, I'll tell you everything, you know, I know about business, and you can figure out whether that's actually the path you want to take. So there is always that tie back for me for teaching. I want to help people start businesses as much as I am successful in what I'm doing. And, you know, if I find my way to some PhDs who are thinking about taking the entrepreneurial route, awesome. Mm-hmm. I'd love to work with them.
You just totally blew my mind with that. I love that idea of hiring people who might want to be doing what you're doing. Yeah. And passing the knowledge along. That's so cool.
Yeah. I think it's fun. And, you know, the idea behind an apprenticeship, you know, years ago, if you were, you know, a metalsmith or something, right? You work with another metalsmith and you learn the craft. And I do think of what I'm doing as a craft. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's helpful to me to have other people to bounce ideas around with and get strategic help. And also, you know, I'm coming to a point where I can't do all the work that's coming my way. Mm-hmm. So it's really good to have those other folks to support me in that way as well.
Yeah. Ooh, what a good, like, I don't know if lesson is the right word, but what a good model for business, as any business, especially creativity and creative businesses.
Yeah. I feel like it could work really well in almost any creative field. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a matter of, you know, I think it's easy when you're first starting out to feel very competitive with other people doing the same thing you're doing.
Right.
And I think that can stop us from seeking out that kind of support and that kind of help. But, you know, I came to a point with my business where I just thought, you know, even if there are other ghostwriters out there, not every client is a good fit for them, and not every client is a perfect fit for me, but you find your way to the clients who are right. And even since the beginning, before I was really doing calling myself a ghostwriter even, mm-hmm. You know, I just realized there's enough work to go around in this business with writing. Yeah. I mean, just people, everybody needs words, right? Every business owner needs words. There's really no reason to feel uber competitive around this stuff, I don't think.
Right. And I do feel like from the perspective of, like, books, for example, like, ghostwriters are almost being brought to the foreground with the author. So they're getting the recognition even on the byline.
Yeah, that's happening more and more, like more of a co-authoring situation.
Yeah.
And honestly, a lot of my clients say that to me. Well, why don't you, you know, why don't we make you a co-author, you know? And, mm-hmm. You know, sometimes I think, yeah, that would be cool. But, you know, it's not much of a benefit for me to honestly have my name on a lot of the books that I write, just because they're so far afield from, you know, what I'm doing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So to me, like, it's not, I appreciate it. I've been in the acknowledgments, for example, in a lot of books, and that's always really nice. It's always a really nice gesture. But again, you know, I work with these experts, and it's their idea. I don't feel at all attached to what I write for these people. So it's not such a big deal, but I do love the collaborative spirit. I wrote a blog a few months ago about, you know, shouldn't ghostwriting come out of the closet kind of a thing. Right. Like, you know, we outsource so many things in our business. Why is it so shameful, you know, to outsource your book writing? Or why is this so much stigma attached to that? I say we applaud, we should applaud people for because it's a lot of time and effort to write a book. And if you're running a business, you're not likely the best writer. So, you know, own that, you know, don't feel bad about that. That's smart business in my mind. Yeah.
Smart business, but also self-aware of what your strengths and weaknesses actually are.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. More self-awareness in business. I'm all about that as well. Yeah.
So how do you know who the right people to work with are?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So the number one question I ask clients, even if you're thinking about writing your own book, this is a huge question you should ask yourself. And that is, what's the business case for your book? Mm. Because again, it's a lot of time and effort. It's hard work. And a lot of authors don't realize once the book is written, you've really only just begun, because now you've got to figure out how to promote that book. And so you've really got to be sure that it's a risk that will pay off for you. Mm-hmm. And also, a lot of authors don't realize they're not likely to make a lot of money on book sales itself. Unless you're on the New York Times bestseller list, it's going to be hard to sell more than a few hundred copies, to be really honest. If you do really, really well and you have a lot of connections and you promote like hell, thousands of copies, sure. But that's, you know, important to keep in perspective. Yeah. So I always ask that question, you know, what's the business case? So are you going to be a speaker? For example, you want to go on the speaking circuit and you can give away your book or you can sell your book as you're speaking, and you can use it to get paid for speaking gigs. Maybe the book helps you reach clients you wouldn't otherwise reach. Maybe it helps you increase your fees because now you have more street credibility because your book is out there. Right. These kinds of things. So that's my number one question. And anyone who doesn't have a good answer to that question is not someone I really want to work with. It's expensive to hire a ghostwriter, which is the other part of the question about whether there's a business case for it. It's not cheap. And, you know, if you're a good writer, if you love writing, if you can see your way to being able to write a book in about a year or something, then you probably should write your own book. You can probably do a really good job. And maybe you need a good editor, you know, once it's finished. But yeah, those are the main things. And I only write business books. So I get sometimes inquiries from people wanting a fiction ghostwriter or wanting me to edit their novels. And I say, I'm not really qualified.
Can you write my memoir?
Yeah. I actually did do one memoir. So I did start out saying nonfiction, and I'm not opposed to doing memoirs. I love memoir as a genre. I like to read memoirs. And that can work. But yeah, there's got to be some business tie-in for me to get really excited. I usually say business development and personal development.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that focus on what the business case is, because I think, again, connecting it to any creative, whether you're making a podcast or producing a film, when you understand the economics behind what you're doing, it's so important to, put down your price tag on it.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, if you just have a hunger to write a book, or, you know, I've talked to grandparents who want to leave a legacy for their grandkids, and I, you know, say, that's amazing. That's great. But I'm not going to take your money to do that for you. if you don't like writing, then record yourself. Like, you don't have to write a book to leave a legacy for your grandkids. But if you do want to do that, you know, just start writing. You know, it doesn't have to be professional at that point, you know.
Right.
It can just be from the heart.
That's such a good point too, because even recording your voice for your legacy allows people to remember what you sounded like. And so sometimes that's even better than a book.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it always comes back to, you know, what's your goal with your book, and does it make sense to work with a professional to get it done, or is it something you can do on your own?
Yep. Yeah. So how did you learn that you were a rebel and a rule breaker?
That's a good question.
I hear pain.
No, I just feel like I've always known, you know, I don't know that there was a moment where I was like, oh yeah, that's me. I know that my dad has always instilled in us that independent streak, and that, you know, from when I was in elementary school, you know, he would always want me to go in and challenge the teachers with with nice. Questions, you know, here he is feeding me questions to ask them to challenge their point of view, you know. And of course, me, I just, all I wanted was for my teachers to love me. I was definitely a teacher's pet. So I never wanted to go in there with challenging questions. And, you know, so I would say probably I grew into my rebelness as I aged and as I matured. I think when I started my business, because I mean, I think becoming a professor was not exactly a rebel move. maybe a little bit, you know, I knew that there was some, you know, what are you going to do with a philosophy major? These right. kinds of questions. And I'm more bullheaded than rebellious. Like, oh no, this is the thing I'm doing. I don't really care what, right. you know, I'm set in my ways. I've made my decision. But I think as an entrepreneur, I started working with people and I realized that the ones who had the big ideas mm-hmm. and the ones who had thoughts about writing books were, you know, if not rebellious, outright rebellious, they were just innovative, you know. Mm. They had ideas that other people in their industries didn't agree with always or mm-hmm. hadn't thought of, hadn't considered. You know, that's why, you know, the book needed to be written, because mm-hmm. they were coming out with these more rebellious ideas. And I think people who have rebellious ideas, people who are rebels, renegades, and mavericks, mm-hmm. you know, they're risk takers in a lot of ways. And I just love working with that kind of person who can say, yeah, it might not work out, but I don't care about that. I believe so much in this mm-hmm. idea that I need to see it through. You know, I need mm-hmm. to, it may not turn out the way I'm hoping, but I think it will. And, you know, I'm going to put everything I have behind it. yeah. Those are great clients to work with, you know, they're saying that, so.
So inevitably, when you start a business, you know, there's that desire to want to please the client and become almost a client's pet, where, you know, yeah. it's not like the teacher's pet where you're like trying to earn their favor, but you're trying to, you know, make the client happy because they're paying you all this money. But like, that's not really the best business, you know, that especially in the creative services. So like, how yeah. did you learn to really embrace that ethos of rebellion and being unafraid to tell your clients that they might even be wrong?
Yeah, that is a challenge. And I would say I've done it because I do it by nature. So philosophy is no exception to this. In fact, the game is to tell each other we're wrong. You know, that's the mm-hmm. whole point, is to poke holes in somebody else's theory. it's a whole game. So, it, you know, it's second nature to me to listen critically to what people say. And if I have a question, you know, how do you know that? You know, that's always a question on my mind. Like, how do you know? What's the evidence? And so I would say that I've always done it, and I haven't always done it as elegantly or as diplomatically as I think I've now figured out how to do. Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, I have been known to say, no, you're wrong. And, you know, when I do editing work, I require, you know, some number of pages, 25 pages, say, of the manuscript, and I'll do a manuscript evaluation on that before I agree to edit the whole book.
Smart.
And so I have been in the place where I got 25 pages of this book, and I realized it wasn't ready for editing. It was really a very rough draft, and it needed a lot more work before it would be ready. But, you know, I just couldn't hold back. You know, I was really just ripping it to shreds. And, you know, that was really unnecessary. But in my mind, I was like, well, I'm not actually going to edit this, so let me give him as much feedback as I can on these 25 pages. But yeah, it did not come out very well for me in the end. He felt very insulted by that feedback. So since then, I've learned more diplomatic ways of challenging people. And it's more in the vein of, you know, well, you know, this is, I understand and I see your perspective, but have you thought about this? Mm-hmm. Or have you considered, you know, this is what I'm seeing and here's how I think it relates to what you're doing, more, you know, rather than you're wrong, let's do it my way. It's, you know, have you considered, maybe this would be a better way. And I find that clients are generally receptive. I mean, they are seeing me as an expert in book writing, mm-hmm. When they come to me. So they're very open to my opinion. And but yes, I don't tend to hold back when I think something, you know, even in a ghostwriting project, like I feel very strongly that this paragraph needs to stay, or, right. you know, this paragraph needs to go, you know, this piece doesn't connect with these other pieces, you know? Huh. Yeah. Yeah.
That's so fascinating. Well, and I imagine too, that as you left academia, you probably wanted nothing to do with anything that resembled it. Mm-hmm. But then the further you went into your business and your desire to teach people, you know, being willing to like teach how to have a thicker skin is probably something that you're just doing much differently now, as opposed to here, have my thick skin. I'll give you exactly what I think. And as opposed to now it's like, ooh, they have a thinner skin. I'm going to teach them how to thicken up before they get reviews.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to look at it. Yeah, for sure. You know, that's part of the collaborative process, you know, trust me, and this is going to be better than it would have been otherwise. You know, that's the kind of look at it. And I think it's also good that I have a very thick skin, because, you know, I always tell people, sometimes the clients hold back on giving me feedback, because they don't want to insult me, and they don't want to step on my toes, or they think you're the expert. I don't really know. But I always say, no, please, like the more information I have about whether this tone works for you and whether it sounds like you, the better. And I am always happy to hear. I would never say this, you know, great, then it shouldn't be in the book. Like, let's figure out a better way to say it. You know, I'm always open to that kind of criticism. And usually it doesn't hurt too much. It goes back to not being attached to those words. For sure.
In the creative world, receiving feedback can be a challenge. So how do you balance that, I guess, need for doing a good job with being told how to do a job better?
Yeah, it's interesting. So this year I've written a few TED Talks, which is kind of new for me.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's fun work. I really like to do it. But there have been a few times with those where I think, because the person is going to be getting up on stage and giving this talk, maybe they look at the words a little more carefully and they're a little more critical because they're thinking, I don't have to say this. And I have, you know, I've heard from people, you know, I think one of the main challenges I have with feedback is that I'm the rebel. I'm like, you should just go all out and you should, you know, call out these people and say these things, you know, and be strong, like really push your opinion, you know. And they're like, oh, I don't know, you know, they're saying, I wouldn't come in so strongly, you know, I wouldn't say it because I know who's going to be in this audience and, you know, these kinds of things. And so that's, I think, sometimes a little bit hard for me to hear, like, oh, we need to soften this up a little bit. I'm always like, no, it's better this way, but okay, I see. I get it. It has to be yours. It has to feel like yours. So yeah, that's when it can be a little bit, and I've run into that a little bit with the TED Talks I've been doing.
Yeah, because I imagine too, that as they're going through reading this out loud, they're identifying through your words to this idea. And if you see the idea bigger than they see the idea or differently, that creates almost a cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
In them.
Yes, it can. Yeah. Because I've done the research. I've seen some of this stuff that maybe I didn't put into the talk quite as clearly and they're not seeing. Yeah. And that can happen with books as well. I've been in situations where I felt like, I know this topic, or not the topic, but I know this, what we've written here, better than they do. And that can be a little bit of an issue, you know, maybe there, it may be, but I always take that as, okay, I need to make the point clearer. Because a reader, if they're not seeing it the way I'm seeing it, then a reader is definitely going to miss the subtlety or whatever, the nuance that they need to be seeing. And I always take that as, okay, we need to find a way to simplify this, or, you know, it's a little too complicated for someone to follow at this point. Mm-hmm. So we need to adjust that. But yeah, it's a fun dance to create a story. Like, TED Talks can be very personal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes I'll have just a few lines about a story, and I'm going to have to spin this into, like, you know, 5 minutes of content, you know. And I'm always like, can you give me some more details? You know, right. What happened? Exactly.
Do you remember what was on the TV?
Right. Right. I'm going to need some more details. I'm not that good at making up those kinds of really specific details. That's why I'm not a good fiction writer or editor. But yeah. But it's really nice. You know, I've had compliments where people say, you know, I read it and it brought tears to my eyes. You know, I'm like, yeah, then I'm hitting the right, the right tone, and I'm getting it all in there.
Yeah. How has this expanded your sense of empathy? Because when you dive into other people's lives, I mean, you are becoming them to some degree.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought to keep in mind. And if you're an aspiring ghostwriter, it's something to consider. There's some psychological toll, right? Mm-hmm. There's some emotional labor that goes on when you're writing a book for someone, for sure. And yeah, man, the empathy bit is really fascinating. I've certainly become more empathetic. I've certainly realized how much being aware of that myself matters. I wrote, for example, a weight loss book for a client, and I seriously started having many more thoughts about body image than, I mean, I have, everyone has body image issues, I think. It's fair to say, but, you know, I just started having many more of those, like, negative thoughts when I'm looking at myself in the mirror. And it was really fascinating how writing that book brought up so many of those things for me. But yeah, you know, because I really do immerse myself in the topic when I'm working on it. And it can take some time for me to kind of pull myself back out in the end. I'm sure that it's a necessary part of the writing process for me, because I always think of myself almost as an actor, like, right, putting on the persona.
Like a method actor.
Yes, exactly. And I will, even when I'm taking notes, I will try to use the language that the person uses, you know. I really do that really, and I think that partly comes pretty naturally to me as well. I'm the oldest of five children, and I'm like 5 years older than the closest sibling. So I learned from a really young age to be empathetic, I think, and to sort of keep the peace in the house in a lot of ways. And I think a lot of that is putting on that hat of the other person and being like, what are you, why are you acting, why is this happening exactly? Oh, I see. Oh, that. Okay. So this is how I have to talk to you, you know, and I do the same thing with the books that I write. You know, it is a matter of getting into the, like I said at the beginning, getting into the sausage and really feeling it and right, figuring out, you know, what's the emotion we're trying to pull out here, and how can we convey it? Yeah.
And how do you remind yourself who you are so that when you're done writing, you can return to yourself and enjoy, you know, maybe you're a vegan and you're tired of sausage at this point.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I know. I think, you know, I say somewhere on my website, presence is a superpower. And I really believe that. You know, I'm always working to be in the present moment. So when the work is done, when I close my computer at the end of the day, I really try hard not to think about it anymore.
Nice.
And so having those breaks away from the work is really helpful. I also, you know, I work on one ghostwriting project at a time, but even while I'm doing that, I have other little blogging projects, or I have mm-hmm. articles that I'm working on. I'm always writing my own content for LinkedIn and for my website and blog for my own blog. And I think that that's helpful to have that break. I might be spending 10 or 20 hours writing your book during the week, but then there's another 30 or 20 hours that I'm working on other things. Which is super helpful. And it helps me to have my own projects that get my own excitement about my business going. So it's not, because it can feel like it's easy to turn writing into, you know, just another check the box kind of job where you feel like you're, you know, in the salt mines on a daily basis. The words become chains, you know, you're like, okay, I can't leave my desk until I write 5,000 words. You know, when it gets to that kind of feeling, and it's 5,000 words for clients, you know, it can feel, it can feel oppressive. So it's, you know, having the balance of the work, working in and working on the business is huge for me. If I'm not spending like 50% of my time on business development or on my own business, yeah, I can start to feel very much like I've built a job for myself. I'm no longer the CEO. I am just someone else's lackey. That's not why I started a business.
And did that balance come naturally, or was that a struggle to kind of find it as your business has progressed?
That's an ongoing struggle for sure. You know?
Okay, good.
It's man. I mean, that's like the number one question I ask in masterminds. You know, how do you balance working on and in the business? And I think it's just, it comes down to saying, you know, I am not putting my business at the bottom of the list. You know, if I'm going to spend these hours, if I plan to schedule these hours for working on marketing, working on business development, taking this course, whatever it is, making sure that time is as important and prioritized as the client work. It doesn't always work. Sometimes I'm just up against deadlines and there's nothing I can do about it. That happens sometimes at the end of the month because I have monthly blogging stuff. And so I'll get into a crunch sometimes where I'm like, oh, I haven't done any blogging and it's the third week of the month, you know, I guess I've got to write 10 blogs before the end of the month, you know, this kind of thing. It's funny because what's even harder is when things are slow, when business is slow, relaxing and just like leaning into business development or leaning into doing my own stuff on the, you know, working on the business rather than in it. But yeah, it's, I don't know. I just, everybody gets into this mindset, I think, where it's like, this, that was the last project I'm ever going to have. Like, I'm done, you know, it's all over.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh my God.
I'm a fraud.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't know what's going on, but no one's ever going to hire me again. That's it. So yeah, it's, man, it's, I wish I had a better strategy for those moments other than just, you know, breathing and just trying to think about, you know, there's only so much you can do. And usually what I do is like kill myself speeding up and trying to do a million things. And I know that any amount of effort shows like 3 months later. I've seen that with marketing or anything else, you know, and so it doesn't even do that much good in the moment to hustle and hustle and thinking, you know, oh, this is going to bring me a client next week. No, no. Like in 3 months, it's good to be hustling now, but, but yeah, you also probably should relax because it's slow and then things are going to get crazy again and you won't have any time to relax and you're going to be upset about that. So
So many lessons in what you just said. And is that what led you to create the LinkedIn roadmap?
Yeah. So the LinkedIn roadmap. Yeah. Since the pandemic, I really started using LinkedIn. Prior to that, I had been getting a lot of business through networking events. And so when those kind of went away, I decided, well, I guess I better really do LinkedIn now, as I've always wanted to do LinkedIn for my business and not really made that a priority. I started posting 5 days a week. I started an interview series called Own Your Expertise. And so I interviewed people about once a week. That's been really fun. But yeah, I discovered, you know, kind of, I learned some things. I learned some formulas. I learned a bit about the algorithm. I learned about what works for my business. And I thought, mm-hmm. oh, I could probably share this with other people. So I created some LinkedIn services actually starting this summer. And one of them is the LinkedIn Roadmap. That's kind of the first step, I would say, to really getting LinkedIn to work for you. And basically, it's a high-level audit of your LinkedIn profile and recommendations for how to improve it. And then a 30-minute call with me where I answer any of your specific questions that you have about LinkedIn. I'd say that's the first step to really getting your content marketing around LinkedIn to work for you in your business.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, you know, I love the ghostwriting and I want that to be the biggest part of the business, but I'm also looking for things I can do with a team. You know, I can hand off to a team, and it seemed like the LinkedIn services are a really good place to start. So yeah, that's the plan. I want to get those clients in there and then I can hire some more writers and make that, you know, do kind of start that agency that I think would be great, or at least a department of writers or something.
So do you see that as the future, where you have the ghostwriting and then you have different branches of content marketing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The smaller writing projects handed over to writers, maybe even finding some real social media experts to do, you know, to offer, you know, beyond LinkedIn, to be able to offer content marketing around Instagram, maybe an ads person, an SEO person, you know, to be able to handle all range of content marketing stuff. Yeah, that would be great.
I also loved how you would not only ghostwrite and create content, but you would generate questions for people. That's awesome. Like when I read that, I'm like, I got excited. I'm like, I could do that. I love that.
Yeah. I know. If I could do that all the time, that would be a great, great business. I would say that. Yeah.
Well, the one question that I wanted to ask, and you might have answered it throughout our conversation, but why do some books become bestsellers and better books live in obscurity in the author's garage?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think one big reason is that the publishing industry is broken. To get on the New York Times bestseller list, you need to sell 25,000 copies of your book. Mm-hmm. And that's tough for most entrepreneurs to do unless you have an audience of 100,000 people. You know, and you've had this naturally built-in audience you've been creating and nurturing for years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it can be done with a lot of grassroots work and a lot of help, but not a lot of authors, unfortunately, have that kind of help. And not a lot of them can afford it. Not a lot of them can put in the time and effort that it needs to grow that kind of following. So yeah, I think promotion is honestly the biggest reason that some books get a lot of acclaim and some don't. I mean, there's definitely books out there that are bestsellers for a good reason, because they're amazing books. But you know, in most cases, at least for the first book, you know, you're just not going to have that kind of traction. So if you're trying to figure out between, you know, three different book ideas that you have, don't go for the one that you think is the gold, you know, as your first book. do something a little, you know, less challenging. I actually am writing my own book right now. I started at the beginning of the year with one idea and then changed because I said, you know, that idea is okay. And, you know, someday I want to write about that, but immediately I could get this book done much more quickly. It's related to the work I'm doing now. it would be sort of a stepping stone, I think, for prospects, you know, read the book and then maybe work with me. That's the smart move right now. That's the smart book to write. Thinking about, you know, not just what you think is the golden idea, but also what will support your business as it is right now is a smart idea. But yeah, if you have a great book idea and it's sitting in your garage, there's nothing more heartbreaking. Right? Like, this is a great book. But of course, a lot of people, you know, you do another edition and then maybe you find your way to a good publisher who can help you get it out there, or you have a real good promotional strategy that you start with. It doesn't mean that those ideas are done, you know, yeah. If it doesn't work out the first go around.
Has your process shifted when you write your own book, or are you following the same process that you do with your clients?
Yeah, you know, in some ways it's the same. My problem is outlining. this is why I require my clients to come to me with outlines. Another reason. Awesome. I sometimes have a hard time outlining for myself. But yeah, you know, I think that was the problem with the first book idea as well, which made me drop it. It's just I couldn't come up with the structure. I couldn't figure out what that looked like. And with mm-hmm. this other book, because it's the work I'm doing now, it's clearer to me, you know, what the starting point is and what the end point is and where we're headed. So yeah, I think if you're having trouble outlining, then maybe it's time to talk to somebody else, you know, get some feedback on it. But it also just might not be the right time to write this book. You might not have enough information at this point to write that book, and you know, let it simmer. There's no shame in putting it on the back burner and trying a new book, you know, another book idea that's more in your wheelhouse.
What was the last book that just totally blew your mind that you read that wasn't one that you wrote?
Oh, great question. I read Adam Grant's Think Again a couple months ago. Really good. That was the first like social science book that I felt like I couldn't put down. As I read most of it on a plane flight, just because I was like, oh, this is so fascinating, you know, right. And I took a ton of notes and just the idea that, you know, the best way to convince somebody to be on your side when they're on the opposite side is, again, not to tell them they're wrong and to give them all the evidence for why they're wrong. It's to really put yourself on their side and listen to their side and really lean into that and then start asking questions around that stuff. Really, really fascinating. There's so many interesting studies in that book about, there's one where parents refusing to get their kids vaccinated, and it's not about the COVID vaccine. This book was written in 2020, but it's actually parents refusing to get the polio vaccine for their children, and how these people went in and convinced these parents to get their kids vaccinated, and it wasn't, here's all the reasons, you know, your kid's going to die if you don't do
it. Here's $1 million.
Yeah, no, it's not that, you know, it's like hearing them out, hearing why they really, you know, have hesitations and answering their questions. And then, you know, from there, trying to, you know, bring them closer to your side, you know, by asking the questions and showing them. You know, talking them through their own thought process, you know, because they are stuck in a certain place. And what you need is to move their thinking. And by the way, I know this from my philosophy experience, when someone comes at you about your view, you get real defensive real fast, and you dig your heels in more and you refuse to listen to what they're saying because you're afraid that you might have to change your mind, right? Or you might have to give up on an idea that you become really attached to. So yeah, so I thought that that Think Again with Adam Grant was super fascinating. I learned so much reading that book.
Now, are you a note taker in the margins, or are you writing in separate notebooks?
In that book, I wrote a bunch in the margins. Okay. I do like to mark up my books with pencil in case anybody gets upset about that. That's my academic training as well. I can't read almost can't read anything without underlining.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's funny because I love the convenience of my Kindle. Mm-hmm. I love reading like fiction, and I love reading like just for fun books on my Kindle. But if I buy a business book accidentally or for whatever reason on the Kindle, I'm always like, oh, now I gotta go buy another copy because I can't read this without underlining. And I hate the highlight feature on Kindle. So. Yeah.
I'm a late convert to the whole world of ebooks.
So oh, yeah.
The pandemic really kind of broadened my ability to check books out from the library.
Oh, yeah.
So I've enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. But there's some things that just bother me to this day.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm the same with audiobooks. I like to listen to audiobooks when I go on road trips. But again, it has to be something I'm not trying to remember, you know. Yes. If I'm trying to keep it in my head, then it's not going to work.
Well, Emily, as we wrap up our time together, you've shared so many amazing points of wisdom. What's one thing you would like listeners to take away from our conversation?
One thing to take away, I would say, I didn't really talk about this too much, but if you are running your own business, if you are an entrepreneur, treat your business as an experiment. That was the number one thing that I needed to hear when I was starting my business, because coming from academia, I really was looking for that syllabus. Just tell me, please, I'm really good at following instructions. Just tell me how to have a successful business. I will do it. I will take those steps. But that's not how this works. You know, you've got to be comfortable trying things and letting them not work out and trying something different, and not getting into your head about, oh my gosh, I'm such a failure because that one, you know, marketing tool didn't work for me, that kind of thing. So I always tell new business owners, and even, I guess, people in careers who are looking to advance their careers, don't be afraid to try something different. You know, no decision you ever make is written in stone. You can always go back and change it. If you hire the wrong person, you can turn around and fire them in a few weeks. You know, it's okay. You can find somebody new. Don't feel ever like stuck because you're like, oh, I made this decision and now I have to live with it. No, that isn't the way to have a successful business, I think.
Yeah. Oh, I love that so much, because it's like, you're absolutely right. Treat it like a bit like an experiment, because it is.
Yeah.
And give it time too. I mean, yes. Sometimes decisions need more than, like, you know, it's like it sometimes it needs 3 months instead of 3 weeks or 3 years to see like results. And I think people give up way too fast.
Yeah, they do. Absolutely. And also, they don't always define what success looks like carefully enough, you know? Like, people will say to me, oh, LinkedIn doesn't work for me. And I think, okay, well, what does working mean? Like, what are we, you know, how, it depends on your goals. And if you set those goals and then figure out how to work toward them, you're going to see the success more easily. And if you're not tracking it, if you're not keeping tabs on things, then how can you say this doesn't work for me? Right. And yeah, it might be a matter of, you need a few more months to get there. But you can only see that if you're tracking the data. So yeah.
There is so much value in this conversation. But if there's one thing that I can't stop thinking about, it's the idea of treating your business like an experiment. As I head into year 16 of Chris Martin Studios, I can see the value in treating it a little bit more like an experiment. Sometimes things get a little bit stale, sometimes patterns stick, habits form, and it's kind of fun just to see where things can go. So wherever you're at in your business journey, think about how you can have a more experimental mindset without needing all of the answers. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.